This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Coming up later today, medical information students should know before going back to college and the role of university health centers. First up this afternoon, school-aged children from preschoolers to college students need vaccines. And while it's true that some vaccine-preventable diseases have become very rare thanks to vaccines, the U.S. experienced a record number of measles cases last year, and about 9,000 cases of whooping cough have been reported to the Centers for Disease Control already in 2015. And here to talk about immunizations is Dr. Oded Zamora, UC Health Family Physician and Assistant Professor in the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, and Dr. Glenn Eagleman, Executive Director of University Health Services at the University of Cincinnati. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. Email talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Glenn and Oded, thanks for being here this afternoon.
Hi.
Thank you.
Oded, some vaccine history. What was the first vaccine?
Well, the first vaccine was for a disease called smallpox, which does not exist anymore because of vaccination. Initially, people try to prevent this horrible disease by taking the pus from the pox and injecting it or cutting people and putting the pus into other people. But this caused a lot of people to become ill. And in 1796, Edward Jenner saw that cowpox, people who have cowpox, tend not to become sick with smallpox. So he tried out and found that if you infect someone with the cowpox, you prevent smallpox. And from then on, this was the first real good vaccine for smallpox, which started the course towards eradication of this disease.
And smallpox, it can be deadly, can it?
Yes, it can be deadly in a very high percentage. And actually, smallpox is really the only disease that's been eradicated thanks to vaccines, fully eradicated from the world. The last case, I think, was in 1977 in Africa.
What about polio? When did that vaccine come along?
Well, polio is an interesting story. Polio used to be a common childhood disease that did not have a lot of side effects. Most people had polio when they were young and got over it. But as sanitation improved in the late 1900s, the time when people were infected with polio was later on in life, and then more of them developed what we know about muscle weakness. So that became a problem more in the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. And that's when people started looking into finding vaccination. Of course, the biggest push was President Roosevelt, FDR, who had polio, and because of that was never filmed or never pictured standing up, hardly. And that vaccination program was funded a lot by the March of Dimes. And there was a big struggle about who will be the first one to get a good vaccine out there. There was a struggle between Jonas Salk and Albert Sabin. Of course, Jonas Salk worked in Pittsburgh, and Albert Sabin worked here in Cincinnati. The March of Dimes backed Jonas Salk, and he was the first one to come out with a big study of vaccination. And Albert Sabin had to take his study to the Soviet Union. Initially, they used two different methods. A lot of years, the Sabin vaccine was given, but then in the 1980s and 90s, it was noted that the only cases of polio in the United States were the ones that were created by the Sabin vaccination because he used a live virus. So since then, we've stopped using the Sabin vaccination, unfortunately for Cincinnati, and we're using only the dead virus vaccination. And don't remember exactly when was the last case of polio in the United States, but I think polio has been eradicated even from the whole Western Hemisphere. And now there's been just read on the story that Africa has been free of polio for a whole year now, which is also another step towards eradicating this disease.
Mm. So overall, how effective have vaccinations been?
Well, even you asking me this question, proves that vaccinations are effective, okay? Because before the age of vaccination, there were about 500,000 cases of measles a year in the United States. Mm-hmm. And now we're talking about, we talk about a few hundred cases a year maybe 1,000, 2,000 cases. So the drop in the number of cases of every disease has been more than 95%, 97%. Some diseases are basically non-existent anymore. Rubella is hardly seen anymore. Polio, like I said, is hardly seen. Smallpox has been eradicated. Again, even though we're talking about mumps and measles outbreaks, the number of people who are affected by it is much, much lower. Even pertussis, which has been resurgent and having more and more cases lately, is not as deadly and not as prevalent as before vaccination.
Glenn?
Yeah, I think a recent example is the varicella vaccine. Mm-hmm. If I just think back 20 years ago when I first started working in university environment, the number of college students who would come down with chickenpox and the significant impact it would have on their lives, their studies, and even if they could continue in school was very significant. And the number was high. And we always tried to figure out, well, how do we manage a student with chickenpox? Can they stay in a residence hall? Do we need to send them home from school? And now with the varicella vaccine and our students coming into university, hopefully vaccinated, we rarely see that. And it just has become a non-issue, and it's one barrier to academic success that we've been able to remove, as well as good health care.
Well, how exactly is a vaccine created, and how exactly does it work, Glenn?
There's different types of vaccines. Some are using parts of the infected organism. Some use an inactivated whole organism. And in essence, it's injected in the body, and it stimulates your natural immune system to be able to fight the organism.
Now, Oded was talking about the measles outbreaks, the mumps, whooping cough. How do you account for the fact that we've seen those, you know, higher numbers of those in the past couple of years?
Well, I think there are several causes. One is that it could be that the vaccinations that we are giving to children are not as effective in older people. So we saw a lot of outbreaks. I mean, the last outbreak of mumps was around Ohio State University. So maybe the vaccine is not as effective after a few years. Second possibility is that the number of people who are vaccinated has decreased, and data shows that the number of people receiving the full doses of measles and mumps and rubella vaccine has decreased in the recent years. And the second reason is that we live in a global society. Okay, we don't live just in the United States. People come into the United States from all over the world, and Americans go all over the world to travel. So we are visiting countries where the vaccine does not exist, and people coming in from countries where the vaccine is not given. So we import some of illnesses, and a lot of these outbreaks are really imported diseases. But they break out because the percentage of people who are vaccinated or are immune to those diseases has decreased, either because of the decrease in the effectiveness of the vaccine or decrease in the number of people vaccinated. And that brings up the issue of herd vaccination. So,
herd vaccine. Yeah. We'll go ahead and explain that.
What does herd immunity, I should say. Herd immunity is very important to issue that, or herd immunity is very important to help protect a large population from an outbreak. So think about a herd that of zebras that tries to protect itself from a lion. The lion has to find one zebra in order to catch, and with all the herd together, it's hard to find. When someone comes in from the United States into the United States, or someone who is ill comes into a certain population, and the illness tries to spread, if all the people around that person are immune to the illness, the illness cannot spread. Whereas if there are a few individuals around that person who are not immune, they can catch the disease and pass it on and on and on. So herd immunity is very important. In order to achieve herd immunity, we need to have a minimal amount of people who are immune to this illness.
So just to clarify, we don't need 100% immunization rate to achieve herd immunity. That rate varies depending on the vaccine and what the infectious agent is.
Glenn, Oded was mentioning that one possibility is fewer people being vaccinated. What do you think is leading to the reduced number of people being vaccinated?
Well, I think that we're seeing a change in the U.S. culture a bit. So if we go back 20 years, most of our students, most people were fine getting vaccinated. But there have been some concerns about vaccines. People, in fact, Dr. Zamora even mentioned, you know, there were concerns about regarding the Sabin vaccine. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, polio cases in the U.S. were because of the vaccine. I think there was some misinformation that came out in medical literature that has since been disproven that has led people link vaccines to various other illnesses or conditions. So there's some misinformation and some fears associated with vaccination. However, they really haven't been founded or grounded in society, in our current society, in our current slew of vaccines.
Oh, there are a lot of people who are concerned about the safety of vaccines, and they'll point out the number of vaccine injuries and deaths, and they'll also point out that vaccinations cause autism and other disorders. What does the research really say about all that, though?
Well, as far as autism, there was one study that was published in The Lancet, but it, just like Lancet, it was disproven. And actually, the lead author lost his license, if I'm not mistaken, because of the data, which was not true data that he used. So there's no real proof of any connection between the measles vaccine and autism. Are vaccines 100% safe? No. Any medication we give is not 100% safe. Every medication has side effects. But in general, they are safe. The serious side effects are rare, and the benefit that we have from the vaccination far outweigh any risk. Even if we talk about the economic side of vaccination, it's been estimated that for every dollar we spend on vaccination, we save $5 in direct cost and about $11 in indirect cost. Well, direct cost will be the money that you spend on going to see the physician and time that you lose off work.
Yeah, and I agree. I do think this is really a risk benefit assessment that an individual needs to make. But I think that Dr. Zamora's point about increasing globalization is a very important one now. Whereas before we were kind of isolated here in the United States. And so if we protected ourselves from some of these infectious diseases, the chance of it coming into our neighborhood and our environment was pretty darn low. Now, with the increasing globalization of our society and our world, these illnesses are coming into our world. And so the need for vaccination to continue this herd immunity is much greater.
Is there a tipping point, Glenn? What percentage of a school or population not being vaccinated for some of these diseases? Is there a tipping point where it becomes dangerous?
It's a great question, because for each vaccine, it's a little different. That's the herd immunity issue. Mm-hmm. So there's not necessarily a set number, but we really like to see that number high 80s or more, high 80%.
We'll continue our discussion about vaccinations. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. My guests this afternoon are Dr. Oded Zamora, UC Health Family Physician and Assistant Professor in the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, and Dr. Glenn Eagleman, Executive Director of University Health Services at the University of Cincinnati. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Glenn, do you... think that each school system or state setting their own immunization policies is good, or should there be universal rules across the country for doing this?
Well, thanks for asking. As someone who's new to the Cincinnati area, I've been here for around 2 months, and I moved here from Washington, D.C. So for the past several years, I worked with the Department of Health and Human Services and other branches of the government. So my bias is, I guess I'm laying it out there, and I do believe that a broader immunization requirement would be very helpful. And the reason is, if you think about it, we're not just staying in our communities, in our school districts, in our towns, in our states. We're traveling. We move around. We're mobile. And so if we have, be it local, regional, or even statewide variations in levels of protection against some of these infectious diseases, are we really accomplishing the overarching public health goal, which is to prevent these immunizations? Infectious diseases don't follow political boundaries. They tend to follow geological boundaries, you know, an ocean or a mountain range. So it's kind of artificial if we draw a line on a map that happens to fit a political need.
You were talking about being required. How does a parent balance that out with doing what they think is right for their child?
Again, requirements do exist on state level, and I know for several federal programs there are requirements. In general, there are exemptions to these requirements, especially medical exemptions and religious exemptions as well. To reiterate, we're not looking for 100% vaccination, so it's okay that there are a few people who do not get this.
Odette, how does the U.S. compare to other developed countries in the percentage of its population that's been immunized? Do you know anything about that?
I think we're doing pretty well. Of course, the more Western European countries are more homogeneous than the United States. They have a lot of them have a smaller population, which is easier to manage, and they're, again, culturally are more homogeneous. So they might have a higher percentage than us, but I think we're doing pretty well. In general, it's more than 90%. So, but there are pockets where the percentage is lower, and Ohio is one of them. Unfortunately, we have on several vaccinations we're in the lower group where there's less than 80% vaccination, mainly because people choose not to vaccinate their children. The state of Ohio does mandate several vaccinations before starting kindergarten and before starting seventh grade. But again, you can ask for an exemption for religious reasons or for personal belief.
At what age should a child be vaccinated?
Well, the first vaccine a child receives is usually on day one of life, which is for hepatitis B. And then we follow that. Usually either a month or 2 months for the second hepatitis B and with other vaccinations. Usually it's 2 months because we like to give the kid a bit of time to relax from the first traumatic event and then give immunization as 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, 12 months, between 12 and 2, and then 2 years, and then again at around 4 or 5.
Glenn, what about preteens and teens? What vaccinations should they be looking at?
So,
you want me to take over?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. I do this on a regular basis.
Yes.
So, before seventh grade in Ohio, everybody must receive another dose of the tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis, which will be their fifth dose. Now, there are a few other vaccinations which are recommended for children that age. The first one is being a meningitis vaccine. A lot of colleges, I don't know if they mandate it or they ask for it or they recommend it, because the risk of meningitis increases when you live in close quarters, and college dorms are such close quarters. The second is the HPV vaccine, which helps protect against cervical cancer and genital warts.
So in terms of when you're heading off to college, definitely one of the things you want to think about is the meningitis vaccine. And there's two distinct types of vaccines out on the market currently, and this is new, and it's something I really want to stress. So there's a conjugate meningitis vaccine that has been out on the market for several years now. In fact, the state of Ohio requires, before you're coming to campus, that you provide information as to whether you have had that vaccine or not. And we know that the vaccination rate is probably around 70% for people in high school who have had that vaccine. A new vaccine against meningitis B just came out on the market within the past several months. Meningitis B is now accounting for approximately 50% of the cases of bacterial meningitis in our country and also in the local Cincinnati community. So at the University of Cincinnati, for example, we are doing a public outreach campaign to try to educate people about this new vaccine, the benefits of it. We are holding vaccination clinics across the campus to try to encourage people to get this vaccine and have information on our website as well to try to help people realize, you know, you've had a meningitis vaccine, but you are not necessarily fully protected from meningitis, that there's a strain out there that really needs protection now.
If your child's behind on vaccinations, is it ever too late to get caught up on those?
It's never too late. Never too late. In fact, especially in the college age setting, we have a lot of people come in from countries where they haven't had vaccines. And it's easy enough, just get started and do it.
Glenn, you're from New York and more recently from D.C., if I understand right. Did they have strict vaccination rules there, especially in New York City, where you have the dense population and lots of people coming in from other states and countries all in that one area?
Yeah, you do find that different parts of the country have more stringent vaccine rules. So the State University of New York system requires immunization if you're going to remain being a student. Otherwise, you're not allowed to continue with your studies. That is true in many different states, especially in the Northeast and on the West Coast.
Now, this is a lot to keep track of, knowing when your child should be vaccinated, what they should be getting, that kind of thing. Are there resources that parents can turn to help them with information on vaccinations?
Yeah. Well, the first resource that you can turn to is a CDC website, which gives a lot of information about the vaccines and about the diseases that they prevent. Another resource is your family physician. You can always come and ask, if I need a vaccine, what do you recommend? Most vaccinations are given when the child is very young, when they're babies, or when they have a mandate from school. That's the best way to remind people to go and become vaccinated. I do not know if the Ohio Department of Health has information, but I think the CDC website is very good, and of course your primary care physician is a very good resource.
Yeah, I strongly agree. There is a lot of misinformation about vaccines online, so you do want to make sure you're checking appropriate healthcare resources. CDC, I'm fairly confident. ODH, mm-hmm. Ohio Department of Health, has excellent information. If you're looking at students who are going for college, the American College Health Association, ACHA.org, has good information. And then also go and look towards your campus health center. So at UC, it's uc.edu/UHS. And there's some good information online. Check those resources. And of course, the individual decision needs to be between you and your healthcare provider.
Well, thanks for joining us this afternoon. Dr. Oded Zamora, UC Health family physician and assistant professor in the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. Dr. Glenn Eagleman, executive director of University Health Services at the University of Cincinnati. And Glenn will be joining us for the second half of the show. Coming up, medical information students should know before heading off to college. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.